take it on the chin. So that's what they did. Pretty much got everything they wanted offensively, from the perimeter to the paint. It's one of those games. We had zero rhythm. Had some early in the first, had some in the third. We cut the lead. Other than that, we just off rhythm. We just had some breakdowns that we can't have.
Do you think maybe settle for the three a little bit too much there in the second half?
No, we're a three-point shooting team.
You just can't live with it that way.
We're a three-point shooting team.
You know, they played a lot of confidence. They got beat last night, but I knew it was going to be a different ball game with us. But they had it going, and then they got enough points in the paint as well. Put us in a lot of defensive situations to mess up. To be a second late, and they capitalize.
Honestly, I think any team, you know, whenever I come out to go to the NFL, I think I'd be honored to play for any team. It's been a dream of mine for such a long time to play in the NFL, and any team that would want to give me that opportunity to be a part of their organization, it'd mean the world to me.
Obviously, the Browns are sort of a quarterback graveyard, but at the same time, it's almost an opportunity. If you do anything remotely, you know, competent, you're going to be loved in Cleveland. Do you think about that at all?
I don't really think about that at all. I mean, whoever, like I said, whoever gives me that opportunity to start for them, that'd just be a great opportunity to do something, play in the NFL. You know, it's been my dream for a long time. So, like I do every single game, every single practice, just pay my respects to the game.
I can't imagine two better tradition-rich programs facing each other. It'd be great for college football. I imagine the fans will really enjoy watching this, and we're going to do our best to put on a great event. Dynamic team. The running back's ridiculous. I finally had a chance to really watch him. Very good receivers, and the quarterback's obviously going to be a top two or three draft pick in the NFL, so that's the biggest issue we're dealing with. You know, this is such a prestigious bowl, and when we got the nod to go play and everybody's excited, then it'll be the first time I can remember in a long, long time that we've done this. So we're going to try to do the best we can. And our player, we got incredible guys. And we're going to do some cool things for our players. Win the game, I think that's going to be very important for his legacy, and play very well. And he's healthy, and I love JT. And he's done so much for me and so much for our program. I just want to see him go out. And only one way to go out, play really well. I think it's our 12th win. It's going to be certainly be a top five, top four, top three team. Great team and a great season.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Welcome indeed to the Extravaganza. Thanks so much for joining us right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, where we are. Toledo's sports leader. We are live and local once again. So many of the shows are taking the Christmas week off, and they're taking the entirety of Monday Christmas Day to Monday New Year's Day. But no, we are live and working hard for you, as we got a lot of good stuff to talk about today. And looking forward to you being a part of that conversation when you are ready, rather. 866-240-1065. 866-240-1065. We got a packed show today. Coming up in about half an hour, Bill Conley will join us. Bill Conley, college football writer extraordinaire for SBNation.com. We'll preview some of the big bowl matchups coming up, including the Cotton Bowl, which involves the Ohio State Buckeyes and the Southern Cal Trojans. By the way, a little tip of the cap there to Sam Darnold, who kind of, I guess tried to put a little separation between himself and his fellow Southern California quarterback. Those two guys might be 1 and 2 in the upcoming NFL draft. Josh Rosen of UCLA saying, "I don't want to play for the Browns," without saying the word Browns. Sam Darnold saying, "I'll play for anybody. It's just a dream to be in the NFL." So tip the cap to him. And obviously the Buckeyes and the Trojans will get after it tomorrow. And then we've got Michigan, of course, taking on. Why am I drawing a blank here, Chris?
Michigan, South Carolina.
South Carolina. Thanks very much. South Carolina coming up in the Outback Bowl in Tampa on New Year's Day, Monday. We'll get a little preview of that from Bill Conley, as well as, of course, the national semifinal games as we look forward to Alabama-Clemson. In fact, no, got to do that in order. Top seed first, Clemson, Alabama, and then, of course, Oklahoma and Georgia. So we'll get a little preview of all of those games with Bill Conley. Then Paul Keels, voice of the Buckeyes, will do a little more personal look at the Ohio State-USC matchup. And then we'll switch to college basketball at 4:35. That'll be time for Coach Todd Kowalczyk and UT Hoops. Rockets, by the way, on a little bit of a better run here, looking for their third win in a row coming up this weekend. So all of that coming up as we get rolling this afternoon. Also, in this one, I just kind of wanted to update. Kush just gave me the update, actually, a few minutes ago, and we'll wait for the confirmation. But yesterday, we were talking about a pretty doggone controversial topic on this program. And it was spawned by an article, an op-ed written by Joseph Hayes that ran in the Detroit Free Press about whether or not Jim Caldwell, the coach of the Lions, is going to be fired. And his take was that if he is fired, it would be a huge mistake. And the only reason people are talking about wanting him fired is because of racism. Because Jim Caldwell apparently wasn't a black coach, it might appear, before he was hired, or when he was hired, but then became one, and now they got to get rid of him because he's a black coach. See how senseless that is? I didn't like it. I asked Jim Cushman to reach out to Joseph Hayes to come on the air with us and discuss this thing and talk about football versus culture in such a way. And according to what we've just found, he's a little busy today. He's a little busy tomorrow. We're trying to book him for the early or middle part of next week. And we'll get back to you as soon as we know that, but I'm very much looking forward to that part of the conversation. All right, so that's what's coming up, and that really leaves this first half hour open. If you would like to get in on any of those subjects, I would love to take your call now. And you're going to have to, like I said, because of the guest lineup that we have got run down for you coming up. A few different things to talk about in this first half hour montage. I wanted to speak, not that necessarily anybody here cares too much, excuse me, not that anybody here in Northwest Ohio carries too much about the Pittsburgh Steelers and the New England Patriots and the James Harrison saga, but if you're in Northwest Ohio, Jim, didn't you tell me that it's there are a lot more Pittsburgh fans in the area, in your opinion, than people realize?
You know, yes.
It's Lions and Browns.
Yeah, I would still say a combination.
Pittsburgh is right there.
Yes, I would say if you combine especially Lions and Browns fans,
yeah,
that's the majority, definitely.
Right.
But the third contingent is Steelers fans. I've run into them in random.
We're kind of closer to Indianapolis.
Yeah, you would think distance wise, maybe the Colts, but no, it's actually the Steelers.
Interesting, very interesting. Okay, and I kind of play to that somewhat, but you know we always spend most of our time talking about Lions and Browns when we do NFL, but this is important. I guess it doesn't matter what part of the country you're in. You're interested in the James Harrison story. But the James Harrison story has taken on a whole new turn. Yesterday, the focus was a lot about, was on, James Harrison, is he showing no loyalty to the Steelers by immediately after being released going to sign with the team that is going to play them probably in 3 weeks or so, or 4 weeks for the AFC Championship? And others saying, why should he do that? Why should he be called disloyal, and why should he feel like he can't go where he wants when the Steelers released him? It was his, he was released. He has the right to go and seek employment elsewhere if they decide we don't want you. And so there were kind of two or three schools of thought here. Number one is, did James Harrison do something disloyal? Number two is, did the Steelers do something stupid by giving him an opportunity, setting him free rather than just holding on to him through the end of the season so that he can't go and join somebody who might, that might come back to bite them in the postseason? Pittsburgh already has a hard enough time getting past New England in Foxborough in the postseason. They've never beaten New England in Foxborough to go to the Super Bowl, okay? And it's been very one-sided overall, whether it's in Pittsburgh or not. So this is already tough enough, and now you give, an experienced, intelligent vet like James Harrison, you turn to him and his knowledge over to Bill Belichick, and oh my gosh, you just made things harder. So is it the Steelers' fault? And the third school of thought is one that we are just now kind of finding out, that the Steelers may not have had even had a choice here, because it wasn't like they just cut James Harrison because James Harrison can't play anymore. They released James Harrison and allowed him to clear waivers and then go join the Patriots because James Harrison so desperately wanted out of Pittsburgh that he made himself a royal pain in the rear end distraction. And several Steelers players are now speaking out about it, including Marquise Pouncey, their all-pro center, who essentially said he erased his Steelers legacy. This is a two-time champion, by the way. Two-time Super Bowl champ. James Harrison is the all-time sack leader in Pittsburgh. James Harrison was the 2008 Defensive Player of the Year. And that was when, by the way, he made one of the most incredible plays in Super Bowl history, a pre-halftime 99-yard interception return for a touchdown. That's still just going to, we'll go down forever. I don't care who you are and who you root for. That'll go down forever. It's one of the great all-time plays in the Super Bowl. But Marquise Pouncey talking about this guy saying he erased all of that legacy. He erased it by his choice. he was the one who made it very, very clear that he wanted out because he wasn't getting any playing time anymore. He spoke out, Pouncey did. Bud Dupree, another outside linebacker, spoke out. Multiple Steelers laying it out there and saying, do you think that the Steelers just decided to get rid of James Harrison on a whim? He wanted out. And many of them are reporting that he would go into team meetings and sleep. Not just quietly, but very vocally, snoring, so as to disrupt the meetings and let everybody know how discontented he was, that he wasn't playing, and how upset he was that he was still there. It was a very, very big situation where the lack of professionalism for one of the great all-time Steeler players forced Mike Tomlin and the front office's hand to the point where they had to get rid of him because of addition by subtraction. It's about more than just, you know, they said, well, they had to clear a roster spot to bring their offensive tackle Marcus Gilbert back because he had been out for four games with a PED suspension. It's more than that. They could have released anybody and still kept James Harrison there, but they just couldn't keep him around anymore because he was making himself a massive distraction for the team. And so now the story takes a much different twist. Here's Maurkice Pouncey, the Steelers All-Pro center, kind of smiling while talking to the press at his locker after their practice yesterday about James Harrison and the Steelers making a potential mistake. Some reporters asking if they made a mistake by letting him go to New England.
Speaking of team MVPs, you don't have to erase James's from the record books now that he went to New England, do you?
He erased himself. He erased his own legacy here.
In case you didn't hear that, that's what I said before. He erased it himself. He erased his own legacy here.
Erased the legacy, really? It's pretty strong.
You don't think so?
You tell me. It's your locker room. Okay?
Yeah, I would think so as a fan.
So are you more surprised he was let go in the first place, or are you more surprised that he went to New England?
Yeah, I mean, he wanted that. It wasn't like the team said, oh, we're going to let go of James Harrison. James Harrison wanted that.
Again, he's kind of soft-spoken. He said he wanted out. It wasn't like the team just said, we don't want James Harrison. He said James Harrison wanted out.
Wanted out?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny to read the stories. Like, it's something he wanted to do, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's not like, oh, they got together and said, oh, we're going to go cut James. Like, no, that's not what happened. And he needs to come out and admit that.
He went on to say that he needs to come out and admit that. James Harrison needs to come out and admit that. This was a choice he made. He wanted out. And he needs to acknowledge that because he's allowing the Steelers to look bad here. Now, the question is why would he want out other than just playing time? Part of it is he's 39 years old. This is very likely his last season. And, in fact, there was kind of a storyline, a narrative going into the 2018 season that he wasn't going to come back. Last year was going to be his last year, but that the Steelers convinced him to come back because they still needed him. And when he said, okay, I'll come back and do this one more time, because he was still a very productive player last year at age 38. So he said, okay, I'll give it one more run. But then they got the opportunity to draft T.J. Watt, who plays his position and who did. And T.J. Watt, quite frankly, beat him out for the starting job and has made it very difficult for Watt to come off the field and for Harrison to go on it. So Harrison feels like he was lied to. He was told he would still have a strong role, and now that he doesn't have one, he has a choice. Be a professional and ride out your last season supporting the younger guy that's on the field in front of you, or be a royal pain in the rear end and force the Steelers to cut you, thereby giving you an opportunity to wreak some sort of weird underhanded vengeance on them by going to the enemy. And that is what led most of the Steelers players to speak out against him and to tell the truth. Jeremy Fowler writes about the Steelers for ESPN.com. And he put a piece together this morning why the Steelers locker room spoke out against James Harrison, Maurkice Pouncey and Bud Dupree among those who did so. And the reason why, essentially, is they did not want everybody believing that James Harrison has been victimized here. James Harrison wasn't the one who somehow has been martyred here by the uncaring Steelers front office. It's his 14th season, and it was filled with all kinds of tomfoolery, missed practices, stadium departures, over inactive statuses. In other words, declared inactive, not playing that day, so he left rather than be on the sideline. Napping, as I said, and snoring through meetings. All kinds of things to make it very, very clear that he did not want to be around anymore. Also, about over the course of the last 3 months, he gave some hints to DKPittsburghSports.com, a sports website, saying that he would have signed somewhere else to play his last year if he knew he was going to play such a limited role, that the Steelers were not necessarily up front with him. So all of this is, you know, a long story short here is that Harrison is a Patriot. And the question becomes, is Harrison a Patriot because that was the best place for him to win a ring? Or is Harrison a Patriot because he wants to stick it to Pittsburgh one final time, feeling like he was lied to when he came back for his 14th season and, you know, at the age of 39 with Pittsburgh? Was this specifically to stick it to Pittsburgh? Because I have to believe that there are some teams looking for some pass rush help that are on the playoff, you know, in the playoff hunt in the NFC, maybe even the NFC's leading teams like Philadelphia, that could really use an experienced veteran like James Harrison once they found out that he had been waived and cleared waivers, that anybody could assign him. I have a feeling he could have said, I got a, just as good of a shot of winning a Super Bowl with the Eagles as I do with the Steelers, or just as good of a shot maybe with, I don't know, the Vikings or, you know, teams that need pass rushers, Saints, those kinds of things. And instead, he goes right to the team that Pittsburgh just played 3 weeks ago. The team, or 2 weeks ago, I guess it would have been. The team that Pittsburgh had beaten, really, with the Jesse James touchdown catch, the go-ahead touchdown catch to win that game in the final seconds before it was overruled by the ridiculous NFL officials in New York. And that are very likely to meet again, this time on the frozen tundra, to borrow that overused phrase, of Foxborough. Did James Harrison do anything wrong by doing this? And I got to tell you, the more I've watched this, the more I've listened to this, and the more I, you know, kind of establish my own opinion on this, I have to tell you, I think James Harrison is going to lose a ton of respect in locker rooms all across the National Football League because of this. Not because he signed wherever he wanted, that's not the issue, but it's how he went about getting out of Pittsburgh in the most unprofessional way possible. And even while the Patriots will certainly celebrate his status there and his presence there because he's going to help them, I think everywhere else people are going to have a really, really lesser opinion, if not an outright negative opinion of James Harrison for doing something to a franchise that he had been, you know, a member of the family for so long. I don't know that anybody is ever going to crack the pantheon of Steelers greatness in terms of their linebackers. Nobody's going to replace Jack Lambert and Jack Ham as the two greatest linebackers in Steelers history. Although Kevin Green, former Steeler outside linebacker, went to the Hall of Fame. Greg Lloyd was All-Pro a few times. Levon Kirkland was All-Pro in the middle. I don't know if anybody is going to crack the Steel Curtain linebackers in terms of the all-time Steelers at that position. But if anybody had a shot, in all truthfulness, it was James Harrison, Defensive Player of the Year, the Super Bowl play against the Cardinals, the all-time sack leader. And now, according to most observers, he won't even ever be inducted into the Steelers' Ring of Honor. He'll never make it there because of not just the fact that he left at the end of his career the way that he did, but the fact that, well, let me rephrase, not just the fact that he left at the end of his career, but the way that he did force his way out of town. At the age of 39. Cush, I mean, you know, Steelers fans around here have to be a little bit, you know, a little bit cheesed by this. And I think legitimately so, that he would force his way out with such immature, unprofessional behavior, thereby, yeah, as Marquise Pouncey said, erasing his own legacy that he had built in that city.
Yeah, and these are essentially reports from the guys as they saw it, you know, in the locker room evolving over the course of this season. And, you know, now with this type of information out there, yeah, suddenly him being a Patriot actually makes, you know, even more sense than before, because in light of this new evidence, it really feels like to me that James Harrison is doing this solely to stick it to the Steelers.
Yeah, solely. It really does.
And he has the background personality that you know, makes this even more, you know, more believable. So it's a bad look for him, bad look for a little bit of his career. Obviously, the Steelers organization and Steelers fans could treat that however they want. If that's going to exclude who statistically, among other things, is one of the Steeler greats of all time, then, you know, that's up to them. And I kind of have a little sympathy for some of those Steelers fans and ones in the organization who going forward would take that kind of opinion of James Harrison.
I wonder if this is something that could affect 5 years after he retires any potential Hall of Fame observation, analysis, discussion. Because
that one's a little trickier than from a Steelers only perspective, well, that seems a little more cut and dry right now.
Well, yeah, I mean, but I'm kind of tying them together, as I kind of said in my opening monologue. I think outside of New England, there's probably 31 other locker rooms who are really, really not thinking very highly of James Harrison. You know, as much as they're enemies, and we know they are, you know, on the field, they're brothers. In arms, insofar as we're all NFL players, we're all members of the union, we all support one another, we try not to bash one another too much because we never know when a trade or a free agent signing is
going
to be teammates. So, you know, they kind of, there's a camaraderie there that people might not realize, and I'm looking at this in a big picture. How does this affect James Harrison's legacy? Marquise Pouncey said he erased his own legacy in Pittsburgh. Okay, and I think that's fair to say, and I think that's accurate too. I just wonder, how does this affect his National Football League legacy? Particularly if, you know, he plays an instrumental role with New England in beating Pittsburgh in the AFC Championship game, should they both make it there. I just wonder how this affects him long term, you know, as far as his legacy in the NFL, and if it's something that could affect, you know, the way. Look, Terrell Owens should be in the Hall of Fame. Terrell Owens should be in the Hall of Fame based on his production. He's not. Why? He's a bad teammate. He was viewed as a bad teammate. Despite all of his production, all of his greatness, he was viewed that way, and it's being held against him.
Not to mention a lightning rod with the media, which is which are some of the ones involved, of course, in the voting.
Yeah, I think less, though. I don't think...
I agree. You know, what you said is the primary.
Yeah,
reason.
You know, he was never at some sort of the edge of a fight with the media the way that, like, for example, in baseball, Barry Bonds was.
Right.
He
Good
wasn't
call.
Just surly. I mean, he was kind of a clown. I mean, certainly not the very best guy, but he wasn't like that. He was just, he was viewed as just, I mean, he had a better relationship with the media than he did with any of his quarterbacks ever. You know, that's one of the things.
You know, that is kind of true now that I'm thinking about it. You know, that is kind of true. And now that I'm thinking about it, that's a little twisted.
Yeah. So, you know, it was more the teammate thing with Terrell Owens. He was a bad teammate. People didn't like the way that he threw quarterbacks under the bus, threw coaches under the bus, and wasn't always about the team. It was always about me first. You know, T.O. is Mio in a lot of cases, and that's what a lot of people didn't like about him, and a lot of people feel like that's why he's not yet in the Hall of Fame, even though he's only been eligible for a year or two. So by that standard, I'm just wondering if the reputation of James Harrison as a teammate is going to take a hit because of the way this all went down, and the Steelers are very publicly Steelers players now.
Yeah.
Not front office, not media relations people, PR people looking to save face for them. These are teammates,
exactly.
Brothers in arms,
yep,
who are calling him out. And when that happens, it means a lot more.
So. Yeah, no, and you're absolutely right about that. And that's why I do kind of think that on some level it probably will affect him. You know, from a national kind of perspective, not as much and not as stark as Steelers specifically, but I think this overall will take a little bit of a hit on him. I question nationally how much. I mean, it's even though there are those that aren't really wanting to like him for reasons in the past, but in terms of a media guy who has a vote, for example, down the line, I think this will affect a little. I just don't know how much.
Well, let's put it this way. The fact that this isn't just a local story, this is the lead story at ESPN and at CBS and others, means around the country, in markets all over the country, and certainly in locker rooms all over the NFL, this is a big deal. This is a big deal to a lot of people. And if he ends up winning a ring with New England, it'll be very interesting to see how that is perceived as well. Okay, that's just one of many NFL stories that we have to talk about, but we also have a lot of college football to get to. So let's get a timeout here. Bottom of the hour Sports Center, then we're going to talk college football with Bill Conley of SB Nation. Nation as bowl season, of course, is here. The big ones are starting tomorrow, of course, with Ohio State and USC in the Cotton Bowl. We got the semifinal games for the national championship and more coming up on New Year's Day. So we got all that coming up. Let's get wild.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents The Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
Buffalo Wild Wings, Wild Stat of the Day. The numbers are now in for the November Vegas books. It was actually not good for them that the Houston Astros won the World Series. Why? Well, the Astros' World Series win meant that the Vegas books lost $11.4 million. That's the largest baseball loss ever for any month, and the most for baseball since Vegas lost around $6.2 million when the Yankees beat the Braves in 1999. Despite that loss, Vegas always wins, right? Well, that's true here as well, because for the entire month of November, Vegas won to the tune of $9.8 million, making it the 52nd straight month Vegas has come out on top. There you go. I'm not much of a gambler, but that's the wild stat as we see it right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket. We're back to talk college football after this.
Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5, The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. 3:40 as we roll onward on this Thursday afternoon. Hope you're having a great day. College football bowl season is always an awful lot of fun, especially when the bowls mean something. And there are two of them that do. Those would be, of course, the national semifinal games. But well, there are also some that are of intrigue for those of us who wonder, should the Big Ten champions have been included in the college football Final Four? Should the Pac-12 champions have been included in the college football Final Four? Well, I think the fact that they're going to square off tomorrow in the Cotton Bowl will give us an answer to that question, or at least some answer as to which one might have been more deserving. So let's talk college football bowls now with the commissioner, de facto commissioner of college football, Bill Conley, who writes college football for SBNation.com. Hey, Bill, good to have you back here in Toledo. Happy New Year, a little bit early to you.
Same to you.
All right. So, first of all, let me just get your take on what I just said. Do you feel as though these bowl games, now that the playoff games have been established as playoff games, I mean, most of the bowl games never meant anything anyway, even pre-BCS, because, you know, it was going to be one of the top two teams who got the vote from the old AP-UPI, you know, a national championship, the way those things were decided. But now that there are, okay, these two are to advance to the championship game, the other ones are even more now than ever, I think, viewed, or in my mind, I view them as just, you know, sponsor bowls. We're going to put a name on something. People are going to make a whole bunch of money for what is a glorified exhibition game. Do you feel that the bowls still have the intrigue that maybe they once did?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about fan intrigue, I think there are kind of waves. You've got at the you've got things like, you know, New Mexico State, their fans rushing the field for getting to 6-6 and them getting to play in a bowl game for the first time in almost 60 years. That's awesome. That was it. That's intrigue on their level, and they, you know, that is a very, very big thing to them. But then you get kind of once you get up to that level of the teams that maybe thought they were going to have a chance at the national title, but it didn't quite work out for whatever reason, maybe there's a little bit of a letdown there, but I think that's always existed too. You know, even before the BCS, you knew if you had a shot at the national title or not, heading into bowl season. So I don't really think it's all changed that much, but there are certainly, you know, I think every team has its own kind of version of that, you know, in terms of disappointment versus excitement versus this versus that. And it plays out very differently across 39 bowls, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's very fair to say. So, and you're right, by the way, about schools that have never been to a bowl game or haven't been there in a long time, you know, they're getting an opportunity to win a game in what's called the quote-unquote postseason, even, you know, for what it's worth, rushing the field and so on. So that is a great thing. I think there's some truth to that, too. All right, let's talk about the Cotton Bowl. Let's talk a little bit about Ohio State and USC. Before we talk about the matchup against one another, did either one of them have a legitimate case, in your opinion, Bill Connolly, to be among the Final Four instead of Alabama, which, of course, did not play in their conference championship game?
Yeah, I thought Ohio State, I had no problem with Alabama making it, honestly. I thought there was a pretty good case. I thought there was a pretty good case for Ohio State, too. I would have personally selected Alabama. I couldn't have complained much if Ohio State got the nod. There were three pretty obvious teams, and there were two with a couple more blemishes on the record. And in the end, the team that didn't get destroyed by Iowa made the playoff. And so, you know, it is what it is. They had a case and they didn't quite make it and so on. But I do think, you know, whatever disappointment there is from that, I think a lot of that was alleviated by the fact that they now get to go play a helmet game. You know, they get to go play, you know, blue blood versus blue blood. Granted, it's not at the Rose Bowl where it feels it should be,
right.
But I think it'll still be the fact that they're playing each other. I think both teams that will lead to both teams playing a very, very high caliber game, and that's very good. That's what we want.
What about USC? You seem to echo the opinion of many analysts who say that if anybody should have been there instead of Alabama or had a better case, it might have been Ohio State. And I continue to wonder about USC. Also a Power 5 conference champion, a team that didn't get blown out by Iowa State, but did have a blowout on their record. But a team that at the end of the day, had a better strength of schedule, a much, much better strength of schedule, as a matter of fact, than Ohio State. And nobody talks about them as saying, you know what, they deserve just as much of a consideration to be in that Final Four as the Buckeyes did. And I wonder, do you think they'll use that as any motivation? Do they feel slighted by the national analysts and those who, and maybe the committee, who never really had them above 8th, 7th, 6th in the final rankings?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, every team uses whatever they can find for motivation and for, you know, disrespect fuel, so to speak. And I mean, USC certainly has some of that.
But some of that is legit and some of it isn't. You know, some of it's manufactured. Yes. They use whatever we have. You know, we've been, but I feel like in their case, they might have a case for it.
Yeah, I think basically this comes down to games on paper versus eyeballs, your eyeball test, I should say. They just weren't as good as Ohio State during the year. They had their some very, very high-caliber moments, beating Stanford the way they did early in the season, and then turning around and beat them again, especially the way they put that game away. Fourth down stand, 98-yard drive or whatever, that was very impressive. They also barely beat UCLA, barely beat Utah, lost to Washington State, barely beat Texas, really, you know, needed the whole 60 minutes to kind of ease past Western Michigan and Cal. They just weren't as good a team as Ohio State. Their highs weren't as high as Ohio State's. And so, to me, like, if you land everything up on paper, then, yeah, I mean, their strength of schedule was solid. They had a case to make. But if you watch those teams play, I just don't think USC was as consistently good. So I would have had a problem with that one. If they would have gotten in instead of Ohio State or Alabama in that fourth spot, it would have been a sign that the committee doesn't actually watch the games enough. They just kind of line everything up on paper with best win, best loss, second bet, worst loss, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm happy. Anytime we see something where it's proof that the committee really is watching the teams and judging the teams, not just lining everything up on paper, which I realize as a stat person, it's weird for me to say, that makes me happy. So I'm okay with USC being a couple steps behind.
So let's talk about how they match up head-to-head, starting with the quarterback situation. Sam Darnold, arguably the top pick in the draft coming up, if nothing else, maybe the second pick, depending on Josh Rosen and whether or not he even declares for the draft,
yeah,
if the Browns have indicated they might take him. But Sam Darnold, one of the most talented guys, JT Barrett, probably not ever going to play quarterback in the National Football League, but he's one of the most accomplished college quarterbacks in Big Ten history with all kinds of passing and total offense records in his essentially 5 years there. How's that quarterback matchup work for you?
Well, I think the biggest thing that Ohio State has going in its favor is USC is not a very good run defending team. That seems like it could be a problem against one of the most efficient run games in college football. So, you know, in theory, the quarterback matchup works pretty well for Ohio State, and that Ohio State doesn't need JT Barrett to go crazy via the air as much as USC will need Sam Darnold to do that. Sam Darnold could do that. You know, he did throw 12 picks. That's fine. I was talking about high moments for USC versus Ohio State. His high moments personally were quite good. And we know that he can lead a team, in individual games to very high heights. So I think that's a really interesting matchup for Ohio State. Ohio State obviously has a very good pass defense against anybody not named Baker Mayfield for the most part. And we'll kind of get to at least an idea of where Sam Darnold kind of, you know, measures up in comparison to OU's passing game and all that. But I do think the trump card here is just that Ohio State's really good at running the ball and USC really isn't all that great at stopping it.
So we're talking to Bill Connolly, SB Nation college football writer, about the Cotton Bowl. What about the other side of the ball? Sam Darnold, obviously, you know, has done some spectacular things over the last couple of years. Some people feel like was not as efficient or as effective, didn't put up as gaudy numbers in this particular season as compared to last year, but still obviously very, very dangerous. And how does the Buckeye, you know, secondary, quite frankly, has been, you know, their Achilles heel in games that they've lost or games that they've, you know, certainly to Baker Mayfield, but even in some wins. They've given up big plays in the passing game. So how does the Buckeye D deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I do think Sam Darnold, early in the year, you know, he had a, you know, what's his name, Tyler Vaughn's freshman receiver. Deontay Burnett was a new number one at the very least. And you saw some growing pains early on. He just wasn't really, you know, he was great against Stanford in that second game, but he was pretty average against Western Michigan, threw a couple picks against Texas, was very, very mediocre in the loss to Washington State. But from that point forward, I think we saw, a higher level of play, for the most part. Even against Notre Dame, like, you know, he was still 20 for 28 passing in that game. It was everything else that went wrong in that game against Notre Dame, but he was still pretty good. He was great against, Oregon State and Utah. Tremendous again down the stretch here against Stanford. I think, you know, a lot of the issues that people have with Sam Darnold's season were early in the year. He's been mostly awesome for about the last 2 months. And so that's obviously going to be a concern there. But, you know, like I said, he has to be great, and probably JT Barrett only needs to be good for Ohio State to win.
So it sounds like you're picking the Buckeyes.
Yes. Yes. Okay. I'm reasonably confident in that. Although, I mean, any team that, you know, I watched the Iowa game, that's never, you know, that's always in your head. We know that Ohio State is capable of something like that, but I don't think they're capable of it in a situation like this.
Fair enough. And of course, the Cotton Bowl is tomorrow, and we'll look forward to watching Ohio State and USC try to settle some things among conference champions snubbed by the bowl committee and the Power Five conference champions, that is. Slightly less important on Monday is Michigan and South Carolina. I just want to ask this on behalf of our Michigan fans here in Northwest Ohio. We got a lot of Maize and Blue fans. How important, if at all, is this game to Brandon Peters in the ongoing, or not ongoing, but the battle to come, with the likes of Shea Patterson, the transfer in from Mississippi, the true freshman Christian McCaffrey, who's supposed to be a stud, and they just brought in another true freshman in the early signing period by the name of Joe Milton. It's going to be a wide-open quarterback battle there. Brandon Peters can really get a leg up in that, yes, if he gets the win on Monday?
I mean, this is a very important game for him. Overall, like, this entire Michigan season has been about building for 2018 to me, which is easy to say when I'm not a fan living through the losses. It's a little easier to, you know, stand back and say, oh, don't worry about it. But I think this is a very, you know, whether this is an important game for Michigan's program or overall, not really. It's a great, great opportunity for Brandon Peters. There's no question about that. You bring Shea Patterson into the mix, you're bringing him in to start. And so, you know, if Peters really is, we saw some really interesting things from him, in a pretty small sample against like Rutgers and Maryland and whatnot. The offense looked much more dangerous with him than with John O'Korn before that. And he's got an opportunity to do something here. It's not a great, I mean, it's not an amazing opportunity. It's against South Carolina, a team that just kind of sits back and waits for you to make a mistake and then pounces on it. They don't really have a lot to offer offensively overall. But it is absolutely an opportunity for him more than anybody else on that team. And if he goes out and torches what's still a pretty good South Carolina defense, not an amazing one, but a solid, sound defense with they prevent big plays, they make you work down the field without making mistakes. If he's able to put up some pretty good numbers there, I think that's all he can ask for. I do think Shea Patterson probably ends up starting when he's eligible, but Peters has a chance.
Gamecocks, offensively, both these teams are very, very similar. Gamecocks, 24 points per game. Michigan, 25 points per game. Gamecocks, 340 yards of total offense a game. Michigan, 354. The difference comes on the defensive side.
Yep.
Michigan allows just 268 yards a game. South Carolina, 51st in the nation, 374 yards allowed per game. So if there's going to be a real difference maker in that game, it could very well be that mediocre or too poor Gamecock defense against that Brandon Peters-led Michigan offense. All right, let's get into the big time now. Bill Connolly joining us from SB Nation College Football. Let's talk first about the early game, the 5 o'clock game, the Georgia Bulldogs, SEC champions, shocking Auburn coming back and beating them just, 3 weeks after Auburn put one on them. They take on Oklahoma, which might have just been the very best team in the country. And we'll talk about that, I suppose, compared to Clemson. But really, most consistently, it might be OU over the last several weeks of the season. And Baker Mayfield just on a mission to obliterate everything in his path. Who do you like in the early game?
Man, I have gone back and forth on this one a lot. My gut says Georgia, but I start to get very paranoid anytime I pick against Baker Mayfield at this point. Baker Mayfield is playing the highest caliber quarterback play that I think we've seen in college football in a few years at this point. Just his ability, his reaction time is something I don't know if I've ever seen before. You watch how quickly his eyes move, and when he sees what he wants, how quickly he gets the ball out or how quickly he starts running to make that happen. It's just a very, very impressive thing. And Georgia, you know, it's funny, like, watching people try to make comparisons, like, well, Georgia got torched deep by Missouri in these little instances like that. They have not faced a Baker Mayfield all season, and it just hasn't been close. And even against Auburn, the way they got beaten by Auburn is not going to apply either. Oklahoma is just a completely different animal, and I'm not sure what happens. I think the most interesting matchup, though, to me, almost happens on the other side of the ball, where you've got Georgia, you know, with the court trying to protect their freshman quarterback for the most part, but having a devastating, you know, 40 times per game running attack, five-headed running back. Oklahoma's defense hasn't faced anything like that. But they also did a really nice job of handling Ohio State's run game, of handling basically all the good run games on their schedule. They contained them for the most part. So, really interesting game. OU's defense at the end of the year was tremendous, just like it was at the beginning of the year. The middle of the year, it was terrible. But they really, they kind of got back into shape. And I don't know what applies here. They haven't faced a Georgia, and Georgia hasn't faced a Baker Mayfield.
Who's more likely to make the big mistake that might cost their team the game? The freshman, the true freshman, Fromm, who just by the nature of being in that moment at that age is asking an awful lot, or the Heisman Trophy winner playing at the highest level you're talking about in the last several years because he's a gunslinger, because he feels like he can make every throw, and maybe that's the wrong throw at the big moment there. I feel like it could be a coin flip as to which guy, for different reasons, makes the critical mistake.
I think, you know, Mayfield's probably more likely to make an individual mistake, but he's also more likely to make up for it. I think that's the most interesting. The early part of this game is going to be very telling. Georgia, for the most part, you know, they would come up with a pretty sound game plan. They'd protect Fromm, make him, they wouldn't, you know, avoid, it's not like they were just running draw plays on every third and nine, but they were trying to contain the awkward downs and distances, contain the big passes he has to make to about 5 or 10. And OU's just going to do it all game. And I think what you saw from the stats is that Georgia was tremendous in the first quarter offensively, very good in the second, pretty good in the third, not quite as good. There wasn't a humongous slippage there, but as the game went on, they were hopefully content enough with their lead and whatever they had going for them that they didn't have to ask Fromm to do too much late in the game. Mayfield's going to, I mean, they just hand the ball to Mayfield. He's going to do it for four quarters, and I think if there's a lack of success in either direction, if Georgia doesn't have success early on, it's going to be very costly, whereas Oklahoma's just going to get chance after chance. They're not going to really mind if they're in an early deficit.
Well, you said you've gone back and forth.
Right now I'm with Georgia. Right now I'm with Georgia, but in the process of talking about the game, I've almost started to lean back towards Oklahoma, too. I love this playoff as a whole because it really is almost a situation where each team has a 25% chance. It's a bunch of coin flips, and I love that.
All right, now Alabama. Oh, by the way, before I talk about Alabama-Clemson briefly, I just had to challenge you on what you said about Mayfield maybe playing the highest level quarterback you've seen in several years. I got to ask you about Deshaun Watson over the last two. I mean, going to the championship game 2 years ago and losing it, but putting up spectacular numbers and guiding his offense the way that it did. Then last year, coming back and avenging that loss and going right back to the game and winning the whole doggone thing. He played some of the highest level quarterbacking I've seen in a long time.
Yeah, there have been a lot of good quarterbacks, yeah. Watson, in 15, almost more than 16. They rallied in 16 towards the end of the year, but they made a lot of mistakes early in 2016. 2015, they were just a wrecking ball for a good portion of that year. But no, I mean, there have clearly been a lot of very good quarterbacks recently. I watch Mayfield.
Who do you pick? Mayfield of 2017 or Watson of 15-16?
I think OU's, I think Mayfield's supporting cast isn't quite as good as Watson's was 2 years ago, but Mayfield himself is playing at a higher level.
Okay, that's fair. I can respect that. Now let's talk about this game here. Alabama, which again, some people felt kind of reputationed their way into this thing after losing to Auburn and not getting to the conference championship game, but there they are. And Clemson, you know, I said if Oklahoma hasn't been the best team over the last 8 weeks of the season as they won all of those in a row, maybe it's been Clemson who has been the most consistent. And maybe that's why they are the number one seed in this whole thing. How do you break that game down?
This really does. I wrote a piece for SB Nation a couple of days ago where I basically said it's really lazy when you say that it all depends on quarterback play. But this game kind of all depends on quarterback play. These are two teams that they're going to lean on their defense. They're going to run the ball as much as they possibly can get away with running the ball. But it's going to come down to which quarterback is able to make more plays on third and eight, because neither running game is going to be able to dominate against these defenses. And so, you know, what we saw against Auburn, for example, the game that Alabama lost, two things were going on. Number one, they were falling into awkward downs and distances quite a bit. And the other thing was that, you know, Alabama runs a lot of RPOs. And that's great if, you know, all the options are equally dangerous. But Auburn was able to do a really nice job of basically dictating what reads Jalen Hurts was making. And it resulted, among other things, it resulted in Alabama running backs only carrying 18 times. Hurts carried almost that many times, and he had to throw a lot. And then they would fall behind schedule, and he'd have to throw even more. They were just able to kind of dictate what Alabama was trying to do offensively, and it backfired majorly on Alabama. I mean, it still required a couple fumbles and all these other things for Alabama to lose, but if Auburn was able to do it, Clemson's definitely going to be able to do it, and it's going to come down to whether, Hurts can make certain throws, whether an Alabama receiver, and they have a bunch of freshman receivers who have shown sparks, who have shown, you know, glimpses of big-time play. They're probably going to be asked to beat a Clemson defensive back, and can they do that? And then on the other side, Clemson's going to be asked all the same questions against Alabama's defense.
So let's size all of that up then. Bill Connelly, SB Nation college football writer extraordinaire, the de facto commissioner of the sport, who wins the rematch again of Alabama-Clemson in the playoffs?
I never pick against Alabama, but I kind of, my gut's saying Clemson at the moment. It makes me feel really weird. This would be about the first time I pick against Alabama in like 5 years, and I'm almost always right to pick Alabama.
Yeah, there's a reason for that.
Right. But I do feel like, I was hoping to see a little bit more recovery from some of Alabama's linebackers. That was certainly, I don't want to say a weakness at the end of the year. Alabama's never going to have weak linebackers, but it was still less of a strength than they're used to. Auburn was able to take advantage of that a little bit, and I think Clemson could too. Clemson will absolutely run those, you know, those mesh routes, those shallow crosses. They'll figure out ways to punish whatever little underneath weakness that Alabama has. And right now, I think Hurts is better than Kelly Bryant, but I think Clemson probably has a little bit more to offer. But like I said, I mean, both of these games are very close to 50-50. So I kind of want to see Mayfield out versus Alabama in the title game. I'm kind of leaning towards Georgia-Clemson at the moment.
Which game would you rather watch, Bill Connelly? If your remote was broken and they were on at the exact same time, one is on one channel, the other is on the other, and you can't change it, which one do you put it on and lock in?
We've seen Alabama-Clemson. You know, we've seen that game play out. Obviously, the pieces are a little different, but we've seen it. I'm very, very, very curious about Georgia-Oklahoma. Give me that game.
Yeah, and Baker Mayfield is just so much fun to watch. No matter what he's doing, whether he's making throwing touchdown passes or crotch grabs,
right,
he's entertaining as all get out, and that's something you certainly want to see. Bill Connelly, SB Nation. Bill, enjoy the games. Enjoy the holiday, obviously, on Monday. We'll look forward to catching up with you next week as we recap all of those and then preview the national championship game. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
You got it. Bill Connelly, SB Nation college football writer there. We're going to stay on the theme of college football after the top of the hour. Sports Center coming your way. Paul Keels, the voice of Yon Buckeyes, taking on USC tomorrow in the Cotton Bowl. We're going to talk to Paul about that matchup coming up next right here on the Ticket.
Take it on the chin. That's what they did. Pretty much got everything they wanted offensively, from the perimeter to the paint. Just one of those games. We had zero rhythm. Had some early in the first, had some in the third. We cut the lead. But other than that, we just off rhythm. We just had some breakdowns that we can't have.
Do you think maybe settle for the three a little bit too much there in the second half?
No, we're a three-point shooting team.
You just can't live with it that way.
We're a three-point shooting team.
You know, they play with a lot of confidence. They got beat last night, but knew it was going to be a different ball game with us. But they had it going, and then they got enough points in the paint as well. Put us in a lot of defensive situations to mess up. To be a second late, and they capitalize.
Honestly, I think any team, you know, whenever I come out to go to the NFL, I think I'd be honored to play for any team. It's been a dream of mine for such a long time to play in the NFL, and any team that would want to give me that opportunity to be a part of their organization, it'd mean the world to me.
Obviously, the Browns are sort of a quarterback graveyard, but at the same time, it's almost an opportunity. If you do anything remotely, you know, competent, you're going to be loved in Cleveland. Do you think about that at all?
I don't really think about that at all. I mean, whoever gives me that opportunity to start for them, that'd just be a great opportunity to do something, play in the NFL. You know, it's been my dream for a long time. So, like I do every single game, every single practice, just pay my respects to the game.
I can't imagine two better tradition-rich programs facing each other. It'd be great for college football. I imagine the fans will really enjoy watching this, and we're going to do our best to put on a great event. Dynamic team. The running back's ridiculous. I finally had a chance to really watch him. Very good receivers, and the quarterback's obviously going to be a top two or three draft pick in the NFL, so that's the biggest issue we're dealing with. You know, this is such a prestigious bowl, and when we got the nod to go play and everybody's excited, then it'll be the first time I can remember in a long, long time that we've done this. So we're going to try to do the best we can, and our player, we got incredible guys, and we're going to do some cool things for our players. Win the game, I think that's going to be very important for his legacy, and play very well. And he's healthy, and I love JT, and he's done so much for me and so much for our program. I just want to see him go out, and only one way to go out, play really well. I think it's a 12th win. It's going to be certainly be a top five, top four, top three team, a great team, and a great season.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
We saved the best for last in the top of the hour montage there. And, of course, that would be Urban Meyer. A lot of very other important stuff going on there. A little bit on the NBA last night. But then you heard Sam Darnold going to be happy going to any NFL team. How much is his focus on his draft status and where he may end up, including potentially in Cleveland with the Browns, where quarterbacks go to die, and how much is he going to be actually focused on Ohio State tomorrow? Will that play an impact or have an impact or play a role in the game at the Cotton Bowl? It is hard to tell, but somebody who might offer some insight on it is the voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes, Mr. Paul Keels, who joins us once again for a little preview of the Cotton Bowl on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Paul, good afternoon, and happy early New Year to you, sir.
And likewise, you too. How you doing, Bob?
I am outstanding. Got some really, really interesting football games to watch over the course of the next 4 days or so, especially going into New Year's Day. And, of course, with your permission, we'll ask about the national semifinal games in addition to the Cotton Bowl here as we talk about Ohio State putting the wraps on the season against USC. I just talked to a national writer about college football a few minutes ago, Paul, and I asked him the same question I'm going to ask you. Do you think that this is because the game doesn't have any bearing on the national championship, but it is between two Power 5 conference champions who did not make the cut, according to the committee. You know, Ohio State nor USC, and both of them, I think, have strong cases to say, hey, we want our Power 5 conference. We ought to be in the hunt for the national championship. Since neither one of them is, do you feel like they'll treat it as kind of a way to really put their imprint on this, that one of them really wants to hammer the other one to the point where they say, you know, we really should have been in that Final Four?
I don't know that it's so much trying to make the statement about what didn't happen. I think that what's really come out of it in the short time we've been down here in Dallas and listening to both coaches at their final press conference today, they understand they're playing very good football teams, and they're going to have to play very well to be able to beat the other team, and that it's a great opportunity. And you know, dovetailing off what you were talking about, I think this is one of those matchups that you would hope, not only for Ohio State and USC fans, but it might capture the casual fans because it is a matchup of two conference champions. It is the last two teams seemingly that didn't get into the playoff field. Two programs that have some history with one another, but don't play one another all that terribly often. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I think that's also part of when you get closer to New Year's Day and you see some of the New Year's Six bowl games and some of the more recognizable teams, that helps. But this is one I think that, you know, not just because it's Ohio State, but because it's these two teams. And, yeah, I think this is, and because of the players involved and the fact that they, you know, by both accounts had very successful seasons, not successful enough to get into the playoff, but that this could be a very good matchup and a good and exciting football game for people to watch.
I think it definitely will be that. The only strange part is that it's not being held in Pasadena, you know.
I agree with this. This is the first time that these two schools will have played, and it's not been in either Los Angeles or Columbus. That is going to be a little strange.
Give us a scouting report on the Trojans. I mean, everybody knows Sam Darnold. Everybody knows what he did last year. Everybody knows he got off to a bit of a slower start this year, and maybe the numbers aren't quite as gaudy as a year ago, but he is still considered to be either the favorite to be the top overall pick or at least one of the top two. So we know him to a large extent. What else can you tell us about the challenge that the Trojans pose for the Buckeyes?
Well, and I think really, Bob, you look at what he's done his last eight games, I think it's 17 touchdowns to 4 interceptions. And he's the guy that, you know, yes, he's been the trigger man when they've not had success. It's been partially probably because of his 12 interceptions and issues where he has fumbled the ball away. But Ronald Jones, their tailback, is a 1,000-yard rusher. He's already number 5 all-time career rushing at USC, a very good tailback behind him in Stephen Carr, and a group of receivers that, you know, kind of like Ohio State's group, that can be go-to big play receivers. Deontay Burnett, Michael Pittman, Stephen Mitchell, and Tyler Vaughns all have the ability to break big plays. Offensively, part of what they've had to deal with is injuries on their offensive line. That was really a key part in when they lost their first game of the year at Washington State this year. Defensively, what jumps out at you is they led the nation with 43 sacks. They've got an outstanding group of linebackers with Achenu Nwosu and Cameron Smith and John Houston, who, when you watch their games, seem to be all over the place. The defensive end named Rasheem Green, who had 9 sacks and was first-team All-Pac-12, and some defensive backs that bring great play and great experience, like Iman Marshall, Chris Hawkins, and Marvell Tell. They've had 24 takeaways during the course of the year. They've had to deal with some of the high-flying offenses in the Pac-12 that they see. And 2 losses, a lopsided loss at Notre Dame, a loss at Washington State when the Cougars were pretty highly ranked, I believe.
They were 16th or something like that.
Something like that, yeah. So, but a team that really shows the ability to play very well on both sides of the football.
To a degree, I suppose. I'm just looking at team stats, Paul, right now, in terms of, you know, offense. Both teams really can move the ball up and down the field. You know, Ohio State averages 523 yards a game, SC 489. But it is on the other side that I kind of wanted to ask you. The Buckeyes give up just 292, and USC 404, and that's in the Pac-12 where you don't, you know, even despite, like you said, some highly ranked teams. Not necessarily perceived to be the strongest conference, at least right now, and they're giving up 404 yards a game. So that's got to be something that really excites JT Barrett and Urban Meyer, and the opportunity to really turn this thing into a shootout if need be.
Yeah, I think that's the part that people are anxious to see, how this defense will respond to Ohio State's offense. And it really took in their conference championship game, it took a big fourth down stand late in their game against Stanford. And a big play that was made by Nwosu, their outstanding linebacker, to be able to stop Stanford from winning that football game. So that will be interesting. And I think also it'll be interesting to see if this Ohio State offense feeding into that can kind of pick up the pace. We saw the 2 big plays in the Big Ten championship game, the big hit to Terry McLaurin, the big screen pass that Paris Campbell caught and ran it into the end zone. You know, will we see J.K. Dobbins run the ball the way he did against Wisconsin? And I think everybody's anxious to see what the final game of J.T. Barrett's collegiate career is like, playing here in his home state, being able to get a bowl victory as a starting quarterback at Ohio State. So that's something that to go along with the one that he had against Notre Dame. So I think that's certainly kind of the interesting part. And if this USC defense does have any weak links, can the Ohio State offense find them?
Let's hit that comparison between these two guys. Since you brought up J.T. Barrett, his final college game, it's in his home state, and one has to wonder, you know, you look over at Sam Darnold, top pick overall potentially in the upcoming draft, and J.T. Barrett, I don't think anybody expects is going to play quarterback in the National Football League if he makes the National Football League. And tell me if that's unfair. That's just my perception of the whole thing. How big of a game is this? I mean, this might very well be the last time J.T. Barrett starts a real contact football game under center.
Well, I think that part's going to be big. And I think, you know, when you just stop and recall all of the things that have happened in the journey of J.T. Barrett coming to Ohio State, you know, being recruited without Urban Meyer seeing him in person because of the say-so of Tom Herman, a guy who, you know, 10 days before the season opener becomes the starter when Braxton Miller gets injured, has an outstanding redshirt freshman year, and then gets hurt and misses the 3 postseason games. The following year has to be in a 2-quarterback battle for much of the year before grabbing it back. And then this year, after the Oklahoma game, people thinking that he should be benched for a quarterback who hadn't taken a single snap, and then he continues to set record after record. You know, and it's who knows what's going to happen to J.T. Barrett after this, whether he'll get a chance to play quarterback in the NFL or someplace else or, you know, another position, something he hasn't done. But I think what will be great is to see this guy continue not only to play on the field the way he has, but to show the same class that he's shown as a young man that we've been fortunate enough to be able to interview, watch him speak, watch him interact with his teammates. And, I think that the fact that he has become what everybody would define what they'd want a college football player to be, whether they're quarterback or whatever, whether they're record setter or not, I think he's a guy that when he's gone and when he's done playing football at Ohio State, those of us who paid attention to it when he was there will very much appreciate everything that he put into it. And you know, Sam Darnold certainly can write a big chapter in what may happen for him if he decides to go pro. He's 20-3 as a starter. a guy that certainly, when this season started, a lot of people thought was the favorite to win the Heisman. And certainly he's been able to have a great season with great talent around him. So it will be interesting to watch those two young men tomorrow night.
Yeah, I really agree. And I don't know what's going to happen with JT, but it has been a remarkable career. We oftentimes, and you know this, you've been doing this long enough, and I've been in the talk radio game, you know, analyzing these kinds of things. We think that if a guy doesn't have an outstanding NFL career, particularly as a quarterback, that it somehow diminishes him in what he did. And, you know, Tim Tebow is probably the prime example of that. You know, a guy won two national championships, and a guy was a Heisman Trophy winner and just did not end up playing very long in the National Football League, and people think bust as a quarterback. But, boy, you don't have to play at a super high level on the next level to have your career and your legacy be defined by what you did in the college game. JT Barrett for the last several years has been just you know, one of the most dangerous weapons in college football, and I hope people remember that going forward. You know, rather than evaluating what he might may or may not be, you know, given the opportunity to do at the next level.
You know, I think, Bob, he's going to win some people over at the NFL level when it comes to combine, when it comes to meetings and things like this. I don't think there's any question that JT Barrett is going to impress somebody in the NFL to give him an opportunity to come to their camp, whether it's as a draft choice, whether it's as a free agent. You know, then what happens from there, who knows. But I think he's, just because of the young man that he is, he's going to impress people that they want to talk to him. They want to be around him, and, you know, he's shown what kind of a teammate he is. And I think he's also shown that, you know, how a kid from Texas has really embraced Ohio State and the fans that follow Ohio State. So, it will be interesting to see what his final game is like on the field tomorrow night, but it will also be with just as much interest that we follow what happens to him as he goes on with his life's work.
I think that's very well said. Paul Keel's joining us, the voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes. Let's just kind of skip ahead, if we can, to New Year's Day, and just to get your thoughts on the two semifinal games, one of which Ohio State would love to have been a part of, and starting with the early game, the 2-3 matchup, and that's Oklahoma and Georgia. Oklahoma's got the Heisman Trophy winner and one of the best quarterbacks that we have seen, or at least having one of the best seasons that we have seen by a college quarterback in quite some time. You know, going against a true freshman for Georgia in Fromm, who has just, has been unflappable, 21 touchdowns and 5 interceptions as a true freshman playing in the SEC and winning the SEC championship over Auburn in the way that they did. How does this one shake out for you, Paul Keels?
You know, I'm interested to see it because I've not had a chance to watch Georgia at all, Bob, and, you know, just other than highlights and things like that. So I'm anxious to get a first good glimpse of what Kirby Smart's team looks like and how they've come together, especially, as you said, with a freshman quarterback. And you know, I think with Oklahoma, you know, Baker Mayfield certainly has been a polarizing figure. And I think whenever the Heisman Trophy winner gets his trophy and then has to go play in a big stage, we're all kind of anxious to see how he backs that up. And Oklahoma certainly possesses maybe one of the best offensive lines in all of the country. And I think when we saw them in September, they were probably better defensively than anybody thought they would be, given the losses they had. There are a lot of people, I think, that have gotten on the Oklahoma train and think that they're riding enough momentum that possibly is going to take them to the next level and also to possibly be a national champion. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see. You're talking about a first-year head coach, and, you know, Kirby, I believe this is Kirby Smart's second year, if I'm not mistaken, at Georgia. But to see how these two coaches in the very early stages of their head coaching career, how they handle this big moment.
Yeah, it's going to be something really, really exciting because I think both teams are really among the most exciting, and particularly Mayfield, who just is, he demands an audience everywhere he goes, no matter what he does. And I think that's going to be just a phenomenal game. And that's only the warm-up. 2-12-1 teams, that's the appetizer for the primetime game, which, of course, is Alabama and Clemson again in the playoffs. 11-1 Bama, 12-1 Clemson. Clemson, arguably the most complete season of anybody. Alabama, of course, crept in a little bit after losing the Iron Bowl at Auburn, but they're just as dangerous as ever. How do you see that one shaping up?
Well, and I think I agree with you about Clemson being complete, and you look at their one loss, and certainly you can see how that occurred with their quarterback being injured going into the game, going out of the game because of injury, and mm-hmm. You know, playing on the road on a Friday night at Syracuse, you know, kind of making for a prime upset stage. And how does Auburn kind of bounce back, and how do they – you know, how does Nick Saban use his psychology on a team that didn't play in their conference championship, a team that maybe some people thought shouldn't be there for a number of different reasons? And also, when you think about Alabama, too, and we've talked about it, Bob, you know, they've had some injuries during the latter portion of the year at their linebacker spot. How might that affect what they're doing? So all I know is that the last 2 years when these two schools have played, they've been outstanding football games. They obviously have a great familiarity with one another. So, you know, that's one that, part of the reason that you want to think that Alabama was picked over everybody else to be in the 14 playoff is because they have the ability and they have the makeup where they could beat any of the other three teams in this field. And that's what I'm anxious to see, is can Alabama validate their presence in the playoff field?
Yeah, and, you know, you're right, particularly when you talk about Nick Saban's psychology. You normally they're playing from a position of favorite, and really, quite frankly, I think they're the favorite here. I don't know about a Vegas line, but I'm just looking at ESPN's Football Power Index and their matchup predictor, and 57.9% chance Alabama wins this, a 42% chance that top-seeded and top-ranked Clemson wins this, but they are the fourth seed. So if, from that standpoint, they are the underdog. And I just wonder how Nick Saban, very, very rarely does he get to play that card from the motivation standpoint, if you will, that nobody believes in us, nobody thinks we deserve to be here, and it's time to show them why we are here and time to show them why we belong here every year.
Well, I hope he remembers how to do that. And I think the other thing that's going to be interesting is the fact that that game's in New Orleans. So you got to think that the fan turnout for both schools, with Clemson and Alabama, is going to be great in New Orleans. And, you know, that's kind of what makes you think. If you want to believe that the playoff committee got it right, you're looking at two games that both could be very tight games and could both very go much down to the wire with great play, great talent, great coaching. And, you know, I think that's what makes these games this year on New Year's Day that much more appealing, whether you have a dog in a fight or not. You know, I think that these are four teams that certainly bring an awful lot as far as competitive matchups in each game and whatever the next matchup ends up being.
Now, Buckeye basketball gives you the day off, right, on Monday, New Year's Day, to watch all of these things, right? You have the game Saturday against Miami of Ohio.
Well, I will not be back in time for the Miami game. So okay. Herb Hallenstein, who normally does Ohio State hockey, will be filling in and doing that. And that's going to be an interesting one after the basketball team, you know, lost to North Carolina in New Orleans last weekend. You know, with some time after that to kind of get things together to see how they get themselves prepped for the last non-conference game before they go back to playing in Big Ten play.
Yeah, yes, indeed. It will be very interesting. So, you know what? Enjoy your time and enjoy all of these games. It should be an awful lot of fun. In addition, of course, to the Cotton Bowl tomorrow. I didn't realize it should make a lot of sense. You're going to call the Cotton Bowl tomorrow night, and then you might not be able to be back for basketball the next day. But enjoy the
Private plane service just hasn't worked out, Bob. It just hasn't worked out yet.
Yeah, well, you know, you can't have everything, I suppose. But you do have the Cotton Bowl, and it's going to be an awful lot of fun. And we'll look forward to the call, Paul. And then, of course, we'll catch up with you again next week.
Sounds good. Have a good
year,
Bob.
I guess I should say.
You got it. Take care.
Thank you, Paul. Enjoy. Paul Keels will have the call for the Buckeyes and the Trojans tomorrow in Dallas at the Cotton Bowl. And then, as he said, he will not be back in time to do the Buckeye basketball game, but we'll catch up with him on all of that stuff coming up when we talk next week. All right, 4:30. That's a lot of football in the last hour, talking with Bill Connolly and with Paul Keels. What do you say we get to round ball, but not Buckeye style, Rocket style? Rockets are heading to Penn to take on Ivy League Penn tomorrow. Chris, are they the Quakers? I think they're the Quakers,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
You must be the Pennsylvania Quakers.
Yeah, they're the Penn Quakers. That's right, yes.
Yeah, I don't know why that just struck me as funny or odd, because I haven't said that in a long time. I guess you don't talk about Penn sports very often, or Ivy League sports in general. But anyway, the Quakers will be hosting the Rockets in a non-conference game, the non-conference finale for the Rockets on Friday. And the head coach of the Rockets is Todd Kowalczyk, and he's going to join us to talk about that matchup and a little bit about the modest two-game winning streak the Rockets are on right now as we continue on the extravaganza this Thursday afternoon right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Oh, back to Bob France, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
We roll right along at 4:38. Thanks for joining us right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket. We are Toledo Sports Leader. A lot of college football over the course of the last hour plus. A really great conversation with Bill Connolly, SB Nation college football writer, with a bowl preview. And then, of course, specific to the Cotton Bowl with Ohio State. We just heard from the voice of the Buckeyes, Paul Keels. Really good stuff there. Time to shift gears into basketball season. Matter of fact, it's time for the Rockets of Toledo to shift gears from non-conference play into conference play. After just one more. And, of course, that one happens out at Penn. Ivy League battle now as the Rockets put their modest two-game winning streak on the line against the Quakers coming up tomorrow. And joining us now to talk about it is the coach of those Toledo Rockets, Todd Kowalczyk. Coach, good to talk to you again. How are you? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Bob. How you doing?
I am outstanding. Very, very well. Right. Thanks for asking. It's going to be a great weekend of college sports and professional football as well, and I'm really looking forward to all of it. And I know you're looking to none of it more than, or forward to none of it more than you are, of course, to the battle against Penn. But before we talk about that, let's talk about this winning streak a little bit. Jackson State, we covered a little bit last week. It was, you know, pretty solid overall victory. But Cleveland State, that was another one on the road. You got to win out there against the Horizon League foe, 77-62. Give me the highlights. What impressed you the most about the effort against the Vikings?
I think our defensive effort kept us in the game in the first half. You know, we were up on much of the first half and just couldn't build a lead. You know, and part of it was offensively. We had a hard time making shots. You know, Marion Jackson was 2 for 10, and that's not like him. I think, you know, him going back home as a freshman starting point guard, he had a ton of family and friends there and probably pressed a little bit too much, and his shots go ahead and showed it. You know, and Trayshawn Fleming had foul goals. So if you factor in the fact that Marion was 2 for 10 and didn't play well offensively, and Trey, you know, sat a great deal of game on the bench because of foul trouble, and then still win by 15, I think that's a pretty good thing.
We're talking to Coach Todd Kowalczyk. Coach, I'm going to ask Jim Cushlin to pick up the phone with you for just a second to see if we can reestablish our connection there, because we're having a bit of a hard time hearing a lot of what you're saying, from an echo sound effect to cutting in and out, and I'm not sure if it's a bad cell connection or whatever it is. Obviously, Coach Kowalczyk is in Philly for the battle against Penn. So, you know, maybe who knows what kind of a hotel room we're talking about or a gym or whatever. So we'll try to reestablish with him. But the Rockets had a couple of very strong defensive showings in the last two victories that we mentioned against Jackson State and then against Cleveland State, as he was just talking about. Two largest victories of the season, by the way, in terms of margin of victory, 83-57 over Jackson State, and then the 15-point win over Cleveland State that we were just talking about. The Rockets held the Vikings to just 39% shooting, and that, of course, is the key. And I'm sure every coach will agree it's about stopping the other team as much, if not more, than scoring yourself. And that's what the Rockets have been doing very, very well. Jalen Sanford, I'll just give you a few numbers here while we reestablish the connection with Coach. And Jim, just let me know when he is there. Jalen Sanford put up 20 and also handed out a team-high 6 assists, just one turnover in the win against the Rockets, against the Vikings. So that certainly is impressive. Sanford also joined in double figures by Nate Navigato at 13. Luke Kanapke, the center, sophomore center, had 12 in that game. And Willie Jackson, sophomore forward, had 12 as well. They played. Okay, good. I'm just kind of running down some of the numbers for the win over Cleveland State as we reestablish that connection, and I'm told he is there now. So let's get back to him, Coach Todd Kowalczyk from Philadelphia. Coach, you got us?
I do, and sorry about that. I'm in a hotel in Philadelphia. Maybe I have bad reception, so it's on the lobby. Can you hear me better now?
Oh, you sound terrific now, and I do understand. Yep, you're on the road and in a big building like that, and you never know what you're going to get. So we missed a little bit about what you were saying about the win over Cleveland State, Coach, because of the equality there. But
yep.
I was just talking about the defensive side, holding the Rockets to 39% to 39% shooting after holding Jackson State to 32%. That looks like the key to those wins, but I'll let you kind of restate some of that.
Well, I think, you know, our defense kept us in the game in the first half. You know, you look at it, you know, Marion Jackson was 2 for 10. And he went, you know, being a freshman point guard, he went back home and probably pressed too much. And because of that, he took some bad and ill-advised shots. And then Trayshawn Fletcher, obviously our best player, was in foul trouble the whole night. So with those two guys not playing particularly well and us to have a 15-point win in the road, very, very pleased in our defensive effort. Offensively in the second half, you know, we shot 71% because we took better shots and we made those shots.
You know, you also had four guys. We'll talk about some of the offensive end. Four guys, despite Fletcher, as you point out, your best player, going to double figures with Sanford, who had 20 and 6 assists. Only one turnover, too, and that's something you got to love, 6 assists and one turnover. Navigato had 13. Kanapke and Jackson each had 12 in that game. So that, you know, that foursome kind of keyed the 70% field goal shooting that you had in the second half there. So you play that kind of defense in the first half and come out and hit those kind of shots at that rate in the second half. That's a pretty good recipe.
We really moved the ball in the second half and took really good shots. I mean, that's our you know, you mentioned that the formula for us is we have to have really good defensive intensity, and our ball pressure, I think, is the catalyst to that. At the point of pickup, you know, meaning our top guys, whether it be
Morion Jackson or Justin Roberts or Jay, whoever's guarding their point guard, whoever brings the ball up, if we have solid ball pressure at the point of pickup, you know, we're better off. I think sometimes we've been going underneath too many screens. Even if they're non-shooters, when you go underneath them, it just makes us a little bit more passive. And then the second huge, huge key, and maybe even more important, we just can't turn the ball over. We're such a good, you know, skilled shooting team that we can't give away possessions, and we've got to make sure that we take care of the ball. And as you and I have discussed many times, sometimes those turnovers can lead to easy baskets, which affects your field goal percentage defense as well.
No question about it. Coach Todd Kowalczyk joining us from Philadelphia, where the Rockets are getting set to take on Penn tomorrow in the last non-conference game on the schedule. Just can you just hit on Treshawn a little bit more about how important he is? You know, I'm just looking at some of the numbers. He is the only player in the conference to be in the top 10 in all three primary statistics, points, rebounds, and assists, 17.1, 8.9, and 4.0, respectively. That's a hell of a start to the season for, you know, the non-conference schedule for this senior.
I mean, you're obviously a basketball guy. That's hard to do.
Yeah.
I mean, think of that. Those top 10 in your league in those three key things. And to be perfectly honest, I think the last two or three games, he's gotten away from that. You know, what makes him special is his versatility. And I think, you know, certainly in the Wright State game and the Detroit game, and then again in Cleveland, I think he's trying to score too much. He's so much better when he's a facilitator, you know, and more of a dual threat where he can get assists and lead us in assists. Because our best offense really is him with the ball in transition. But in a couple of those games, I think he tried to score too much, and you know, it affected him. And if he's going to have a chance and opportunity to play after here, it's going to be because of his versatility, not because of his scoring ability.
He had six turnovers in the game against Cleveland State, only seven shots. So when you say he's trying to score too much, I did not watch the game. So I'm just, in my mind's eye, I'm saying, okay, only took seven shots. How's he trying to score too much? Was it a case of trying to get inside? Was it, you know, was he turning it over on the dribble as he's trying to attack too much and maybe into places where there wasn't an opening? Is that what happened?
Well, out of those six, three of them were offensive fouls. They're charges.
Oh, okay. So there you go. That's exactly what I mean. Yeah. Pressing the action a little too much.
Yeah, and he is a phenomenal passer. We, you know, and I just think that there's certain things that as a coach you can teach. Others you can't. If a kid's got bad hands, he's got bad hands. You're not changing that. Mm-hmm. And if he's a bad passer or a bad feel, you can't change vision. There's no drills for that. He's got tremendous vision, tremendous feel. And in that game, I thought he just put his head down and bullied it a little bit, trying to score too much. And part of it, and he did it against Wright State too, I think part of it is he felt like he needed to make a play. It's not out of selfishness at all. It's just he just felt the urgency that he had to make a play. And I think he's better when he understands that play very simply could be just a simple pass.
That's such an interesting thing, because while I totally agree with you, and the six turnovers and three charges, you know, lends itself to your argument there, but how do you balance that? How do you tell a leader to do both things, to have that sense of, I know we need a bucket, and I'm the guy. I'm the go-to guy. I take it upon myself, as you say, not from a sense of selfishness, but a sense of responsibility and leadership as the leading scorer on this team. I need to be aggressive, but I also need to know when to defer. That's a hard thing to teach a kid, even an experienced kid as a senior.
I think it's just you take the play that they give you, you know, and he's going to get an awful lot of attention. He's going to get a ton of attention by Penn tomorrow, because the word's out on him. He's a good player. People are going to be in gaps, you know, gap principles where when he puts the ball to the floor, they're going to be there ready to help. So, you know, I think he's been getting in a little bit too deep. You know, and he's a guy that, you know, maybe you want him to have one offensive foul a game. You know, maybe that's a good thing to have one. That means he's being aggressive.
Right.
But not three. And not six turnovers.
There's a limit to that aggression.
Yeah.
Aggressiveness.
Yeah.
No,
there's a fine line. There's a point where, you know, you're gonna have a couple charges. That's okay, you know, but, you know, you can't have three of them, and you know, maybe the number is one a game or one every other game. I don't know what the number is, but we'll find it. And he'll find it. He just needs to relax and let the game come to him. And he will. He's unselfish. He's a team guy, and he's talented.
few more good minutes with Coach Todd Kowalczyk of the Rockets. They are in Philadelphia getting ready to take on Penn tomorrow in the last non-conference game of the regular season schedule. Jim Kushlin is with us as well. Jimmy's got a question for you, Coach. Go ahead, Jim.
I want you to zoom out a little bit if we could, Coach. Yeah, we got the one more out-of-conference game that you guys are obviously there for tomorrow night at Penn. But so far on the season, 7-5, so looking to go 8-5. You can get a win tomorrow. Give me one of the main positives and one of the main negatives from your point of view as the head coach of how the out-of-conference slate has gone so far.
Oh, the negative is we had a bad week. You know, we had a bad week, you know, at home, played well enough to beat a good Marshall team, had you know, up 13 in the second half, up 7 with 3 to play, and, you know, and just didn't, we made some crucial turnovers down the stretch, you know, and didn't finish that game out. It's extremely disappointing, and then we followed with the final exams and you know, got beat by a team, you know, that frustrated us too much. We lost our confidence against Wright State. So I'd say 7-5, disappointed with that. But, you know, looking at it big picture wise, we had a bad week. That's it. We've had some really good games and some really good, we played against some good teams. We've got some good road wins. You know, got some good home wins against a, you know, really good St. Joe's team and a really good Oakland team. You know, I think, you know, having Willie Jackson come back for that Wright State game probably, you know, hurt us a little bit just to try to get into the flow of the game and try to get him in there. And, you know, that probably, I think now we're much better off. He's got a game or two under his belt. But I think it's, you know, time will tell. I mean, I think this team is talented enough and good enough to win our league, but I think there's a lot of teams that are probably saying that right now.
Coach, let's look ahead to where you are right now, and that is in Philadelphia for the game against Penn. They have won 3 out of 4 in their place. You guys have lost 3 out of 5 away from the friendly confines of Savage. So talk about the challenge of getting this win on the road.
Well, we're playing in the Palestra. And if you know college basketball, you know it's the most historic arena in all of college basketball, which is going to be a great thing for our guys. And they're a really good team. They're 9-4, a really good team, very, very skilled. Play very similar to us, you know, and one thing I spent a lot of my career on the East Coast. I know how good Penn basketball is. I didn't realize until today, and this is something that I bet you people in Toledo have no idea. They're the 19th winningest college basketball program in the history of college basketball.
I never guessed that in a million years.
Pretty impressive.
Yeah, it really is. And more specifically to where they are now, they're playing really good basketball. They've won 4 in a row. And so, you know, the challenge is there for you guys. You know what? Outside of just Penn, just Ivy League basketball as a whole, how do you characterize that? So many people kind of look past that until there's a, you know, a Raleigh-Massimino team, you know, beating a Georgetown team or something like that, you know, in the NCAA tournament. But just overall, do people in the Midwest underestimate the quality of Ivy League basketball, Coach?
I hate to have, you know, say that you're generalizing, and but you know, not as athletic as some other leagues as maybe you would maybe expect. Mm-hmm. Unbelievably skilled, very, very tough, and as you would imagine, extremely smart basketball teams that don't beat themselves. And you know, Cornell, you know, had a point guard. I said this after the game. It was, to me, Juice Brown, but 6'2", 6'3". And was, you know, because of that, maybe better than Juice Brown. Good basketball player. I mean, you know, Penn's a good team. There's a lot of, you know, Princeton's a really, really good team. Harvard is, you know, played really well the last couple of years. And now Yale is really good again. So it's a good league. It's a competitive league. I think the difference is there are some bad teams in that league, which in the Mid-American Conference right now, there are none.
I don't know why I threw Raleigh Massimino's name in there. That's not the upset in the that I was thinking of. He was Cleveland State when they beat Indiana, of course. I was talking about when Princeton beat Georgetown, so my apologies for that one. But
Pete Carril, yeah.
Pete Carril, right. To your larger point, though, you're right about these kids not beating themselves. I mean, you know, basketball smarts aren't always, you know, on the same level of book smarts, which, of course, you know, the Ivy League is known for, but they are really, really heady kids who play the game the right way. To the point about Penn, what is it that they do best? It looks like they can fill it up when they want to. Delaware State is not exactly having a great season. They're 2-13, but Penn just put 105 on them in their last game yesterday.
Well, I watched, you know, that game, and that was, you know, Delaware State's not very good. So the only thing I took away from that game is Delaware State's shot selection fueled their transition. That's really about it.
But aside from that, though, I mean, just looking at Penn, they put up points, 81, 73, 78, and then the 105 against Delaware State. This team can fill it up if they want to.
They're not as athletic as us, not as good inside as us, but shoot the ball, really well. And they have three guys that come off the bench that shoot extremely well. One of them has not made a 2-point field goal all year. How about that for a stat?
Wow. How about that?
And another one only had 4 2-point field goals his entire season last year. So, I mean, they got some guys that come off the bench that are just designated shooters. So when they come off the bench, we got to make sure we're running them off the 3-point line and closing out with high hands. And if that means we get beat off the dribble occasionally, we're going to have to live with that. We cannot let them shoot threes.
You mentioned, just to wrap this up, Coach, you mentioned about the history of the Palestra, but a lot of fans may or may not know about that. What do you tell your guys about playing there?
We talked about it. I love college basketball. I know, obviously the history of the game, but that doesn't mean that my players know it. So we talked about the Palestra and about the Big Five. And I'm not sure they even know what the Big Five was. But the Big Five games are all still played at the Palestra, except when Villanova, hosts. Villanova will only play at Villanova. But the other ones are always at the Palestra. They have a lot of doubleheaders, and it's just a neat, neat venue right in the heart of Philadelphia.
It's sometimes called the cathedral of college basketball.
It should be.
Yeah, and it really does have the kind of history. So that's kind of a cool thing that you're able to get them on the schedule and make this one of the non-conference games, and the kids hopefully will remember that for a long time. Obviously, it's the only one you're worried about right now, but on the other side of the new year, the MAC schedule starts, and we look forward to talking to you about that as you get the ball rolling against Buffalo. Hopefully you get a win and make it 3 in a row to go into that MAC season, Coach, and thanks so much for your time, and once again, I wish you a happy new year.
Happy New Year, guys.
Thank you so much. Coach Todd Kowalczyk, he's a fun interview each and every week that we talk to him, and we're very, very lucky to be able to do that. He's just a very, very good guy to talk to. Even if we're not talking about Toledo basketball, you can tell. You can sit there and talk to Todd Kowalczyk just about basketball for 2 hours and never, ever, realize that 2 hours have gone by. It's just really fun conversation. Okay, that's it. We're done. I hear music. That means it's time for Drive Time coming your way right here on The Ticket. Jim Kushelin sitting in the big chair for Mike Miller on Drive Time, so stick around for that. And don't forget, we've got another free-for-all Friday edition. We're going to look back the year that was, a review of 2017 in sports on tomorrow's edition of The Extravaganza. We'll talk to you then.